Now, in what was a momentous year of social change in 1969, the Rolling Stones experienced the most significant 12 months of their career. At the start of 69, they're a successful blues band, returning to their rock and roll roots after recent experiments with psychedelia. By December, they'd released the classic album Let It Bleed, lost one of their founding members, played an era-defining concert at Hyde Park to 500,000 people, and witnessed a fan stabbed to death at the Altamont Speedway concert. Rolling Stones 69 is a definitive account of the transformative year that saw the Stones truly earn their reputation as the greatest rock and roll band in the world. Really looking forward to speaking to him. His name, the man who's written this tome, is Patrick Humphreys. He joins me line on the line now. Good afternoon to you, Patrick.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you with us. So, for those of those who didn't know what was going on in the Rolling Stones world, 1967-68 had been their Satanic Majesty's request, isn't it?
Yes. Their rather tepid answer to Sgt. Pepper. I think it was still perceived as probably their weakest ever album. But they did get it back together for Beggar's Banquet in 68. But, of course, they all... One thing my book, I think, shows just how far behind... They were always one step behind the Beatles. You know, whatever they did, the Beatles always seemed to have been there first. And I think 69 is the year when they really surged ahead, not least because, of course, we didn't know at the time, but the Beatles were effectively breaking up. And, of course, the Stones had the field themselves. But they also came back with a stonkingly good, I think, their best album, Let It Bleed.
Ah, stonkingly good album. And one of the things that you could say about it at the same time is that, you know, the Beatles may have been doing all sorts of wonderful furpery in the studio, but the Stones were a live rhythm and blues band, and they were live and they were playing concerts.
Well, yes, they hadn't played London for nearly 3 years. It was a one-off show in 68, but the only reason Hyde Park is cemented in so many people's minds is, well, there's a number of reasons. One is Mick in that dress. You can't get away from that image. The other was him reading the Shelley poem in memory of Brian, who died 48 hours before. Then the butterflies that literally went a bit limp. But also the people who were there said how ragged the Stones sounded. And I think they'd been tuning up in a caravan, and as soon as they hit the stage, all the tunings went wonky. So they sounded pretty rough. But, as you say, 500,000 people were just delighted to see them back in action.
So give me a little bit about then, because you've written this as a book. You can't look at the music in the 60s and late 60s without having some sort of social context as well. You've had 1968, you've had, you know, fighting on the streets, you've had the Paris student revolts, you've had Grosvenor Park anti-Vietnam as well in the UK. You've had, of course, the Stones' own drug bust in 67. So when they came into 69, you know, what was their reputation like? And Brian obviously wasn't with them at that point, was he?
Well, he was sort of nominally with them. I mean, you're absolutely right. They had this reputation, you know, even though the Beatles admitted taking drugs and doing all sorts of things they shouldn't have done, the Stones were still perceived as being the bad boys. They were the rebels. They were the ones who wouldn't take any recognition from Her Majesty the Queen, you know. They were the ones who seemed to be... they seemed to spend more time in court than they did in a recording studio. But, I mean, what... You're absolutely right. Played out against 69, you had... In America, when they undertook the tour in December, there were 71 skyjackings alone. There were the Black Panthers shootouts with the police, the Charles Manson murders, the weathermen were blowing up buildings, inner city riots, the remnants of the Chicago trial from 68, and songs like Gimme Shelter and Midnight Rambler and Let It Bleed. They seemed to throb with the pulse of those very unsettling times. And it was hanging over it all was Vietnam, which was still raging.
And so, you know, you've got with the album that they're going to bring out at the end of the year, obviously we talk about sort of the Black Panther, the Weathermen, Charles Manson murders. I mean, had the Stones become a very much sort of London, LA type boot, you know, jetting between the two kind of thing, transatlantic?
Yes, I mean, Let It Bleed began, as most of their classic albums did, at Barnes Olympic Studios. I mean, the Beatles had Abbey Road, the Stones had Olympic, and they got some... most of the classic stuff, certainly in the 60s, was recorded there. They knew they had to keep ahead of the game. They knew they had to build on Beggar's Banquet. They couldn't slip back and do another Satanic Majesties. But Brian, I mean, you can see from the footage, there was that film that Jean-Luc Godard made, which is a terrible film, but it's very good on the Stones in the recording studio trying to nail... a song in the studio at Barnes. And you can see Brian is literally fading away in front of your eyes. Now, what I found in my book, researching my book, was it wasn't so much his condition that made the band get rid of him, but the fact that he actually had a drug conviction. Mick and Keith, as you mentioned, were busted famously in 67, but their convictions were overturned. Brian had a drug conviction from 1968, which meant he would never, ever be able to get a work visa for America. And it's hard to believe now, but the Stones financially were really struggling in 1969, and the only way they could get large sums of money quickly was to tour America, and for that they needed work permits and they needed a new guitarist. So that's really why Brian was booted out.
Give me a little bit, just get my timelines right. Altimore happens before or after Hyde Park?
Hyde Park was July 69.
Yeah.
Then also they did an American tour in November 69,
right,
which if it had ended in Boston at the end of November 69, would have gone down as one of the great rock and roll tours of all time. The reviews were incredible. They were at the top of their game. They were touring on the back of a really strong album. Mick Taylor had fitted in seamlessly. But the pressure was on them from the underground press. I mean, as I say, they were still seen as rock and roll rebels. And the underground press in America were complaining about the ticket prices. They were saying that the straight press were on the Stone side now, and that the pressure was on them to play a free festival. Now, I think in the back of his mind, Mick thought, right, this will be really one up on the Beatles, because the Beatles never ever played a festival. So the original plans for what became Altamont were a dream. I mean, it was going to be 300,000 people in the desert in California, beautiful summer's evening, the greatest rock and roll band at the top of their game. What could possibly go wrong?
Mm.
Well, as we know, it drew a line really under the 60s. I mean, being policed by the Hells Angels, the UK Hells Angels had policed the Hyde Park concert, but these were pussycats. The American Hells Angels were strong. These were outlaws. These were strong men.
Let's go back. Let's go back then a bit. Then so let's go because I want to do this in sort of chronicle because it makes sense that way. Just get in my mind because I wanted to come on to that point. The difference between Hyde Park and Altamont. So obviously the Stones are booked in to do Hyde Park. Was Brian going to be a part of the band or had he already gone?
They went down to see him. Mick and Keith and Charlie Watts went down to see him and say, look, effectively, mate, this isn't working, and he was effectively sacked, ironically, tragically, from the group he founded. I mean, of course, he was the founder of the Rolling Stones. He was the guy who pestered the BBC and the music press to get records played and gigs sorted out. But I think the tragedy with Brian was he was just physically and mentally incapable of writing an original song. And the band realised that to compete with the Beatles from about 64 onwards, they couldn't keep doing cover versions of Buddy Holly or even Beatles songs. They had to come up with their own material. Brian couldn't. He never wrote an original song in his life. It was down to Mick and Keith. That's when the dynamic of the group shifted. And of course, by 69, Brian was in a bad way. He left London to a lovely little house in East Sussex where A.A. Milne, who wrote the Winnie the Pooh books, had lived. And it's a lovely place. And I think he left London to get away from the drugs. There were four pubs in this tiny village. And the last photos you see of Brian, he put on quite a bit of weight. I think he was drinking beer. I think he was coming off the drugs. But he died in this accident at the swimming pool at his home at Cotchford Farm on the 3rd of July, 69, and the Stones were locked in to play with their new guitarist Mick Taylor, were locked in to play Hyde Park on the 5th of July. So the event became a memorial in a way to Brian.
Without sounding facile, I mean, how big an effect did the loss of one of the founding members have on the rest of the band?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, he'd pretty much lost all input into the group by then. He was, he played a few exotic chords on Let It Bleed, but his glory days were gone. And Mick and Keith, I mean, the Glimmer Twins, that fantastic, the dynamic between Mick and Keith, that's what kept the Stones going then, and God love them, keeps them going now.
Mm. I mean, everybody sort of it's perhaps the thing about style over substance, but you said there, because people think, oh, Hyde Park 69, there's Mick in a dress and in a white dress, and he releases Thousands of Butterflies, Reed, Shelley. But as you said, it's one of those things where the imagery, perhaps, as through the passage of time, and it's 50 years ago, blimey, is the imagery is perhaps much stronger. Everybody seems to have been there, but as you said, the sound was pretty ropey.
It was pretty ropey. I mean, they look back on it and knew it was not their finest hour, but they proved that they could do it. They proved that they could function as a rock and roll band again with a new... I mean, Mick Taylor was only 20 when he joined the Stones. And his first gig with them was in front of... I reckon there were more people in Hyde Park that day, the biggest crowd in London since the coronation. I mean, it was a huge event. And I think it was getting them back. But they knew that they were... working on Let It Bleed. They knew they were onto something, you know. They knew they were, and the Stones always work best when they've got a strong album behind them.
So, as we said before, they had, and this will come into play a bit later on, but the security at Hyde Park was done by British Hells Angels.
Yes.
There's a difference that comes to the fore as they approach Altamore.
Well, I remember seeing British Hells Angels queuing for buses, you know, back in the day. I mean, these were sort of pimply youths who wanted to be outlaws. The American Hells Angels were, I mean, these were like descendants of, you know, Jesse James and Butch Cassidy. I mean, these were tough men. And you can see in the film of Gimme Shelter that the loathing in the eyes of the Hells Angels when Mick is up there camping it up and capering around the stage. I mean, these were hard men. The idea was that the Stones would be greeted by a carnival of Hells Angels on their motorbikes when they landed in San Francisco, like a Roman triumph to Golden Gate Park, which is where they're going to play. But as soon as word got out, the Stones are going to play in this park, it became obvious that there's no way they could accommodate the crowd. So the location kept shifting.
Yeah.
And this is, of course, what led to the tragedy of Altamont, because it wasn't designed for those crowds at all.
I mean, because it was supposed to go to Laguna Seca, wasn't it, which was a up by Monterey, which was a racing circuit up there, which had the facilities and the access roads, and it ends up being in basically this dirt track thing in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
Literally nowhere. You see the film and you can see it's in the middle of a desert. And you're absolutely right, the location after Golden Gate, one reason why the stage is so pathetic at Altamont, it was for the earlier location, it was going to slot into to a slope in a natural amphitheatre, so they would have been about 20 feet above the crowd. But of course at Altamont, as you can see from the film and photographs, they're only about 3 feet above the crowd.
Yeah.
There were no toilets, I mean, and there was a bad atmosphere from the beginning. Everyone wanted it to be another Woodstock. Woodstock in August 69 had been, you know, 3 days of peace, love and music, and there were beautiful people. Altamont was ugly and in so many ways, and the people were, not just the Angels, but the crowd were taking very, by all accounts, very, very bad acid. They were drinking, mixing it with cheap red wine. Even before the Hells Angels arrived, there was just, in the terminology of the time, there were bad vibes at Altamont.
I've interviewed people about Altamont before, and I mean, there were 3 deaths over the festival weekend. Somebody drowned trying to cross a reservoir, somebody was killed in a car, and then, of course, there's Meredith and his slaying, which is happens in full view of the stage. And that you can see Mick and the feeling is that if they walk off the stage, the Hells Angels will basically, you know, go mad.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, I think they didn't see the killing. You can see it in the film, and you can see he has got a gun. I mean, there's a wonderful book I drew on for my book by an American writer called Joel Selvin about Altamont, and a really definitive account. And he said, now, why was Meredith Hunter packing a gun at Altamont? I mean, he was a young black guy. My theory is that if you look at the film of all those big festivals in the 60s, there are very few black faces. It was young, predominantly white, middle-class people. Now, maybe he felt there was going to be a race issue. The Hells Angels were notoriously racist. Maybe he felt that was an issue. Why he took a gun to a concert? One theory is that he wanted to go down as a rock and roll Lee Harvey Oswald and kill Mick Jagger on stage, you know. Mm. You'll never know, of course. You know, you'll never know. But you can see in the film with Gimme Shelter, which still packs a tremendous punch, even when you see it today and you know what's coming. When you see the Angels launch into him with their knives, it's terrifying.
And also the other thing was when you see Mick, when he sees that footage for the first time as well.
Yes. It's one of the very few times in a long career when Mick Jagger lost control. And you get that on the stage as well. You can see they're all, he's stoned, he's been smoking a bit of dope, you know. He's in a very, and of course he could only see probably the first 10 rows at Altamont at the festival. But he knows there's something going wrong, and you hear him, you know, using all the hippie speak, hey children, you know, come on, let's love one another, cool it, you know. But it's got out of control by then. The whole thing has got completely out of control.
I mean, it's...
And I think the tragedy of Altamont is that, you know, it's December 69, you'd had Woodstock, you'd had all these big festivals, you'd had, you know, Abbey Road, you'd had Let It Bleed, you had these classic albums. And in a way, Altamont was the death of the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, it's been said, I mean, you've got Woodstock, and then this is the dark side, this is the flip side. But out of this, they get out of Altamont somehow alive, and then they go back and they release the album, and the album is possibly, you know, one of the finest albums ever released.
I think, yes, I think it is. I mean, I think it's certainly their best record. I think that they do stuff on... Well, I think there's that imperial run for the Stones. I think it begins with Beggar's Banquet, it carries on to Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers and Exile on Main Street. I mean, those are the records for me which are the foundation of the greatness of the Rolling Stones. And of those, I think Let It Bleed is the best. And I think, to be perfectly honest, Charles, I think the reason alone for is that the last track on the last Rolling Stones album, the 1960s, is You Can't Always Get What You Want, which is this symphonic, wonderful thing. And you've got this London Bach choir on it, you know, with the Rolling Stones. I mean, they originally wanted a black gospel choir on it. And somebody... So, oh, hey, man, you know, wouldn't it be really cool to have, like, a classical choir on it? And there is this, I opened my book with this, there was a clip on YouTube of a London Bach choir all looking like your mum and dad looked in the 60s.
Right.
And you've got Mick looking at his satanic best, and there's this incredible culture clash. But my goodness me, it works on record.
What was the reaction like then, and when they, you know, when it finally hit the streets? Immediate success. The Stones, you know, did the Stones know that they'd done a master? I mean, they obviously didn't know they were going to start. This would be a run of, you know, two or three more albums, but they must.
No, they knew they got a good one. They knew that they got Honky Tonk Women as a standalone single, and then they'd come up with Let It Bleed, and the reviews for the American tour had been triumphant. And of course, by the beginning of 1970, when they reconvened, it was announced the Beatles were breaking up. So of course they really did have the feel to themselves.
You must be a mind reader. That was going to be my next thing, actually. But it really does. I mean, they have. It's like saying, right, there you go. You know, you've got all the open space in front of you. Go play, and they did.
They did. I mean, and I think one thing my book research was quite almost unconsciously, but subconsciously revealed is that the Stones were always one step behind the Beatles until 69. I mean, as a record producer, the Beatles had George Martin, who even on those early records got an incredible depth to that sound of the Beatles. The Stones had Andrew Lou Goldham, who, you know, by his own admission, couldn't produce his way out of a paper bag. The Stones never ever made a film. The Beatles did Hard Day's Night and Help, which I think is very underrated. The Stones, when they released Beggar's Banquet, which was a triumphant comeback, because of the controversy over the album sleeve, it had to come out with a white cover. The Beatles' white album had come out a fortnight before. The Rolling Stones' Rock and Roll Circus, I think, is a far better film than Magical Mystery Tour, but they didn't like it, so nobody saw it for 40 years. So they were always one step behind the Beatles, and then suddenly with Let It Bleed, I think they really raced ahead.
So 50 years since that Hyde Park concert, 50 years since 1969, what made you decide, apart from the obvious, to go back and revisit this period of time, and who did you speak to?
Well, I think, you know, the world doesn't need another book about the Rolling Stones, another biography of the Rolling Stones. I mean, I think we all know the story about how Mick and Keith met on Dartford Railway platform with, Chuck Berry LPs. You know, and we've had the sex and the drug stuff. We've had all that. I just thought 69 was a transformative year for them, and I think the culture generally, which I hope my book does display. They don't do interviews. I mean, Mick and Keith will not break cover unless ticket sales are a bit slow or there's a new album they want to promote. You know, they just don't. Which I think is fair enough. I mean, they have been doing this, lest we forget, since Harold Macmillan was Prime Minister.
Right, yeah.
There is not a question you can ask Mick Jagger. He literally has been asked 100,000 times before. You know, they've no reason to do this. So I didn't even bother. But what I did was I contacted journalists who knew them in the 1960s, around late 69, Chris Welsh at Melody Maker and Keith Olsen at NME. And they did these long interviews with them when you know, the Mick Jagger would come and sit and happily chat for 2 or 3 hours and again saying, well, I can't imagine myself doing this when I'm 33, you know, and that's what, 50 years ago, you know, in his 20s. You know, so the journalists had these great friends. Chris Welsh, I mean, it's lovely. The Stones publicist, Les Perrin, my goodness, he earned his salary in the 60s. He always used to refer to Mick as Michael Philip.
Right.
Chris would say, well, will Mick be available for interviews? And Liz would say, Michael Philip will be available for interviews, yes. And little things like that I just thought were fascinating. And the mechanics of how the Stones functioned then, and how Mick wanted to become a press tycoon. He wanted to oversee the UK edition of Rolling Stone magazine, which fell by the wayside. The business problems they had with Alan Klein. There's all sorts of things going on at that period. And, of course, you know, even then, when they announced tours, the headline was always, will this be the last time for the Stones? And bless them, as we speak, they're touring America now.
And we're asking ourselves the very same question.
I think what's going to do for them, and I say this in the book, I don't think it's going to be a drug orgy or a desert apocalypse or an assassin. I think what's going to do for the Stones is what affects most their audience, which is going to be a hip replacement or a torn ligament or arthritis that stops Keith coming out with those incredible riffs. I think it's going to be quite a mundane thing that's going to grind them to a halt. But I mean, when you consider now, Mick is now 6 years older than Churchill was when he became Prime Minister. It's an incredible story.
The book is called Rolling Stone 69. It's out now. It's by Omnibus Press, isn't it? Pat, yes. If people want to get hold of you or find out more about you or the book, is there a website? Is there sort of social media?
Well, no, I haven't got a website. I'm on Facebook, right. And I keep meaning to get a website. But, I mean, Amazon is stocking it, and it should be available. It is available now. And, you know, I think it's about 80% about 69. I mean, you have to say what led to 69. You have to say what happened afterwards, you know, how they went from touring in a Bedford van to 3 747s taking the stage crew around the world. Now, you know, it's the bulk of the book is about 69. And I have to say, I've been writing about rock and roll for 40 years, and I found out stuff researching this book that I didn't know, and I figured if I don't know it, it's going to come fresh to quite a few people.
And I'm holding the tome in my very hot little hands at the moment. That's the sound of the book in the background. The book is called Rolling Stone 69. It's out now. It's by Patrick Humphreys. Patrick, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure. I'm so delighted that you enjoyed it. And you obviously think they've got some potential as well.
I think they might go far, those boys.
Yeah,
you know what I
reckon.
Mean?
Yeah.